Hello, I am Sam Amon, your non-binary host, and this is the 50th episode of The Art of Asymmetrical Warfare. Today we'll be talking about the fall of the Alash Orda and the Jadeeds. I have so many mixed feelings today because this is the last episode of season two. Season two has been very challenging in a lot of good ways, and it really forced me to grow in how I create the podcast and how I do my research. And I'll be sharing some of my takeaways in the behind the scenes episodes, but very excited that the last episode of the season is also our 50th episode, which is amazing to me. And I'm really looking forward to next season. Season 3, which is doing a focus on the Irish Civil War. So after this episode, I'm going to take a month break, so I'm going to take May off. The third season will launch in June. I think I'm going to have two recap episodes about the Irish War for Independence and the Treaty, which will be like early and mid-June, and then the first real episode discussing the Civil War will be on June 28th in honor of the assault on the Four Courts, which is one of the big battles, the Third Civil War. So that's the plan. For those who started engaging with my podcast because of Central Asia, don't fret. After the Irish Civil War, we will be returning to Central Asia to talk about the Third Anglo-Afghan War and the Xinjiang and Mongolian bids for independence, as I promised. I just need time to do research. And for those who want to learn more about Ireland, I want to cover. While I love researching and writing scripts and recording episodes, it's hard to do without finances. Even when I'm borrowing materials from the library, I still need to pay for things like web hosting costs, subscriptions such as Canva, food, travel, etc. If you've enjoyed my last two seasons and are intrigued by the topics I'm planning to cover, then please join my Patreon. www.patreon.com/AOAwarfare. Not only will you be supporting me, but you'll gain early access to my episodes, listen to exclusive content, watch more behind-the-scenes videos, and even get a shout-out in my episodes. And now that the begging for money part is over, it's time for making history. So I can't believe I've gone this many episodes without mentioning Biden's terrible immigration policies. For those of you who don't know, Biden has implemented several immigrant policies that are the exact same as Trump's policies. He recently passed a rule that bans migrants who are traveling through other countries on their way to the U.S.-Mexico border from applying for asylum. So, like, if you're in Colombia and you're trying to get to the U.S., you can't pass through any other country to apply for asylum. This just doesn't make any sense. This is not how asylum works. To be an asylee, you have to be unable to return to your home country. If your home country is so dangerous, do you think anyone is just going to hang around in their country of origin while waiting for the United States immigration system to slowly grind to life? Like, they don't have time to apply for a visa. They don't have time to, like, find flights directly from their country to the United States. They may not even have the funds for that. What you're going to do is, if your country is so dangerous, you're going to flee to a temporary country, most likely ending up in a refugee camp, and then you're going to engage with the United States. It's just common sense. To justify this stupidity, he said, either come through normal means, like I said, as if anyone can request a visa while they're fleeing for their lives, or find asylum elsewhere. Which is hard to do when Europe is implementing similar policies, and the other countries, like, you know, the Latin American countries, Middle Eastern countries, the African countries, they're already taking more than their share of refugees. It is starting to affect their country and their stability. And also, just to mention, the United States is partially, if not directly, responsible for a majority of refugees. Either through direct warfare, like Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Sudan, we're in Sudan right now, or just through our policies like Cuba, North Korea, Russia, Iran, China, like, we're responsible for a majority of refugees, and we're not taking them in, and now we're making it harder for them to seek asylum in the United States. I've also heard that Biden is considering an expedited removal policy, which means Border Patrol can deport migrants without a hearing before a judge. asylum seekers already have to wait before they can be interviewed by USCIS agents, and this change could expand the wait time exponentially, meaning we're going to have people trapped in cages. Again, Tustin Border and Patrol are the terrible people who starved children and adults and left them exposed to the elements, increasing the number of sicknesses and deaths. There are also reports that they raped and tortured asylum seekers while they were in their custody. So this is just the same thing that Trump was doing. It's just now the Democrats are doing it, and we're supposed to be okay with that. So what can we do? First, we have to call our representatives, especially our Democratic representatives, especially if they are running for re-election in 2024 or going to make a bid for the presidency. We need to call them and demand them to put pressure on Biden to end the Remain in Mexico program, which was a Trump program that he still hasn't ended, end the expedited removals, end the prison camps on the border, pour money into USCIS so they can address the logistical issues on the border instead of relying on a militant response, end the 287G contracts, which enables ICE to deputize the police as ICE agents, expanding their jurisdiction in a very scary way, and end this asylum ban. If we wanted to turn into an anti-immigrant fascist state, we would have elected Republicans. We voted for the Democrats partly because they were supposed to repair our immigration system and stand with immigrants. I worked at the Refugee Processing Center during the Obama administration, and even then, seeking asylum was a nightmare. We were failing immigrants back then. Can you imagine how fascist we've turned since Obama? Syria, Yemen, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, Colombia, Guatemala, El Salvador, and many other countries have been affected by short-sighted American policies and warmongering, and now we've turned our back on the problems we created, and we're telling immigrants we've displaced just to deal with it. You have to call your representatives and tell them we have a responsibility to care for the people our foreign policy and our wars have displaced. After calling your representative, join an organization fighting for immigrant rights. If you're in Chicago, you should join the Never Again Chicago chapter, because we've got huge plans for the summer. We're still planning them, so I don't want to say anything, but we have huge plans. If you're in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Never Again chapter is fantastic, and so is Voces de la Frontera Action. Voces did so much work during this year's election to turn the Wisconsin Supreme Court blue. They're just an amazing organization. If you're not in Chicago, there are hundreds of Never Again chapters all over the country, and if there isn't a chapter, reach out to the home chapter, and they'll help you create one of your own. We actually just created a document about how to do that, so now would be the perfect time to create your own chapter. I'll provide a link to the Chicago, Wisconsin, and the Maine Never Again chapters in the description. Speaking of the bigger Never Again chapter, they're hosting the Migrant Solidarity Assembly, an anti-fascist gathering from June 9th to 12th in August, Texas. There will also be a virtual component, so there's no reason to put yourself in danger, either through COVID-19 or by flying into Texas. I highly recommend attending the assembly if you can. We'll be doing trainings, power building, community building, and skills building events throughout the weekend. It should be very powerful and inspiring, and it's a great way to learn about the immigrant activist movement and to learn organizing skills, because even if you want to help with immigration, but you also want to help with abortion or whatever, you'll learn skills that can help you no matter what your topic of interest is. There's another group called OCAD, which has several petitions asking ICE to release several refugees they're holding in custody. Please go to their website, which I'll provide in the description, and sign the petitions. I know that it seems like they don't do anything, but OCAD has been amazing. They've been able to use these petitions and get a lot of people out of ICE custody just through community support. It's really amazing to see, and it only works if we support them. They're also focused on ensuring that the newly elected Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson eliminates the gang database. The gang database is a tool in Chicago used by the Chicago Police Department to surveil, harass, and target Black and Brown communities. It's a disgusting racist tool cops use to hurt their favorite targets, and it needs to be dismantled. And it connects to immigration, because a lot of people that get caught up in this database are immigrants of some sort. And then if you take into account that ICE can deputize police officers to be ICE agents, this database also turns into a list of immigrants that, ICE wants to deport or ICE wants to arrest, or maybe they're undocumented. So it's just a terrible tool that needs to be dismantled. OCAD is also focusing on expanding sanctuary in Chicago. Technically, we're a sanctuary city, but we could do a lot better in terms of being a sanctuary city. So OCAD is working Chicago Immigration Working Group to eliminate the carve-outs that allow City of Chicago to collaborate with ICE, such as instructing officers to refuse to work with ICE, to refuse to transfer police into ICE custody unless presented with a valid warrant, and to end all data sharing with DHS or ICE. And again, that connects to ending the gang database, because it's really easy to not share something that isn't there, as opposed to like making a rule and then trusting your cops to follow it. If you're not in Chicago, RACES is a great organization to check out. They have several different campaigns going on, such as making sure Biden doesn't reinstate family detention, ends the asylum ban I mentioned a little earlier, and forcing ICE to make immigration bond procedures publicly available on their website. If you ever looked at an ICE website, it's the most useless piece of trash on the internet because it tells you nothing, which is another reason why ICE is so terrible. So RACES is working to try to bring some accountability and transparency into what ICE is doing. Things are bad everywhere, but Biden's fascist immigrant policies are being ignored because so much is going on. That doesn't mean we can let this administration get away with being Republican light just because the entire country's on fire. Even if you just spend 5 minutes calling your representative and asking them to protect immigrants, it can make a huge difference. And now, time to talk about an equally depressing topic, the fall of the Alash Orda and the Jadids. For the European Soviets, the creation of the five Central Asian states was a quote-unquote second revolution, one that strengthened their presence and power within the region. Gone were the days they'd have to compromise on the cultural and religious fronts. Instead, they could take advantage of the centralization of government to implement true communist reforms and initiatives. Its biggest threat was the cadre of nationally-minded intelligentsia. By 1926, war had been declared against the Alash Orda and the Jadids. It was initiated by the OGPU and spearheaded by indigenous actors, some who had been Jadids themselves or were educated by them, but who now wanted to prove their communist credentials. However, the OGPU and the European Soviets didn't trust these new attack dogs, finding an ever-increasingly large number of local actors who were guilty of nationalism. And thus, a fake conspiracy was created that grew so large, everyone lost control of it until it finally ate itself to a painful and bloody death. Part 1. The First Arrests. It all started in January 1925, when the OGPU created the Commission for Working Out Questions on Attracting the Party's Attention to the Work of the OGPU in the Struggle with Bourgeoisie Nationalist Groups, and with counter-revolutionary ideology. Note to future communists, make your committee names shorter, please, for the love of God. This commission's goal was to root out a nationalist and counter-revolutionary conspiracy and report it to the higher-ups as proof that the local actors could not be trusted. As Lev Nikolaevich Bulsky, an OGPU officer in Central Asia, explained, it was no secret to anyone that those who, quote, fought us for 5 years, have not been beaten either physically, economically, or spiritually, and that their influence on the masses is still enormous. End quote is from Abdi Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. This predicament was worsened by the petite bourgeoisie governments of the Central Asian states who, quote, wanted to ensure themselves against Soviet influence and the attraction of the model of the Soviet rule in Central Asia. End quote is from Abdi Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. He further explained that the OGPU's task was, quote, a harsh struggle with the malicious national intelligentsia by way of revealing to the masses their pan-Islamic and their sell-out Anglophile essence. Quote, again, is from Deep Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. Of course, they made their jobs easier and harder by defining nationalism incredibly broadly. They claimed that nationalism could cover everything, from alt-right condemnation of the Soviet order to expressions of discontent with the pace the Soviet policies were being implemented. So either you completely hated the Soviets, or you loved communism so much, but the Soviets were too slow. Or both ideas could get you in trouble with the OGPU. They viewed Kolonnatsiya, which was supposed to integrate local actors into the Soviet system, as a, quote, manifestation of the contemporary tactic of the anti-Soviet struggle of Uzbek nationalists, the infiltration of the Soviet apparat and the party, the preparation of youth, etc., quote is from Abdi Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. It's an interesting, quote, saying the quiet part out loud moment. The OGPU were afraid of being contaminated by the local actors and that any apparatus that relied on Central Asians could never truly be communists. So a lot to unpack with that idea. It's racist, it's bigoted, And it's very paranoid, which makes sense that it originates with the OGPU. In his book, The Veiled Empire, Douglas Northrop argues that by 1926, the Soviets were identifying themselves in opposition to their Central Asian counterparts. I've talked a bit about this in episode 48, but there was this nagging feeling that as Europeans and as vanguards of the communist revolution, they had to be better than their Central Asian counterparts. And if communism wasn't really working out in Central Asia, it's because the heart of the communist apparatus had been infected by the local actors. And thus, the OGPU could prove itself as a true communist bureau by finding the secret conspiracy to infiltrate and destroy communism from the inside out. So it's not that the policies were bad or that Stalin was crazy and wrong. It's that there was this corruption inherent within Central Asia. And it was the OGPU's job to find this corruption and rip it out. In spring 1926, the OGPU arrested several people who had been members of the Kokon autonomy, but didn't join the Soviet apparatuses of power after their Kokon autonomy fell and Frenza destroyed all the emirs. The OGPU claimed that they were, quote, former leaders of armed struggle against Soviet power, but several members of the Samarkand intellectuals recognized these arrests as a, quote, ill-fated colonial policy of Soviet power, its tendency to cleave the national intelligentsia for colonial goals. And both quotes are from Adib Khali's book, Making Uzbekistan. Part 1A, A Society Turns on Itself. The OGPU arrests triggered a new series of attacks against the Jadids. Akmal Ikrimov, Feyzullah Zhozayev's rival, and his young communists publicly attacked the Jadids for failing to align their previous reforms and activities to communist principles. So back in like 1912, 1914, the Jadids were wrong to not embrace communist principles. This would have been impossible because class hadn't meant anything in pre-1920 Central Asia, and there was no tradition of political organization along socialist lines at the time. The Jadids were radical enough just trying to do educational reform. Ikrimov had also called the Jadids the mouthpiece of the national bourgeoisie, who had resisted the Soviet rule for so long by using the ideology of Chauvinism, Turkism, Islamism, and had gone as far as calling for help from the Basmachi and English imperialists. Several articles attacked the Jadids, proclaiming that there were two groups of intellectuals, those who developed before the revolution and were thus, quote, nationalists and representatives of mercantile capital, and those who developed during Soviet rule and were thus servants of the workers and the peasants. The Jadids were denounced for being involved with members the Soviets deemed as reactionary, counter-revolutionary, and dangerous. A few indigenous Soviets argued that the Jadids should still be of some use. Abdulhay Tozhev, secretary of the Tashkent Party and a young communist, wrote, "Of course the party does not want to cast them aside or have no dealings with them. It would be wrong to do so. Of course we have to use those old intellectuals who can be used to work those who can be worked." Ramzhan Inogemov, the young communist commissar for education, wrote, quote, "Our task should be to turn intellectuals who are close to the ideals of the Soviets into true servants of the Soviet order." And both quotes are from Avdiy Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. This sentiment, however, earned Ramzhan the wrath of Ikrimov and the other young communists, and he was marked as a nationalist who, quote, "provided support to the nationalist intelligentsia." He was demoted to a low-level position in a rural village and was persecuted throughout his life. Soon there would be no one to defend the Jadids except for the Jadids themselves. Feyzullah took the lead in trying to defend his Jadid comrades. He shielded Fitchrat from Ikrimov's attacks, claiming that Fitchrat's books should continue to be published because, quote, "Fitchrat's books are the property of our culture and do not contradict our policy." Quote is from Adib Khali's book, Making Uzbekistan. He argued that the Jadids were not a bourgeoisie movement, but a semi-proletarian group. It wasn't a homogeneous entity that could be painted with one brush. Some Jadids turned their backs on communism, but others embraced communism. His arguments didn't go far, and instead opened him up to attacks by Ikrimov and the historian P.G. Galozo, who accused him for not using Marxist categories in his analysis and for turning the young Bukharans into revolutionaries and communists. Zhozhev was forced to amend his analysis, but he remained in power for now. It's unclear if he ever realized how fragile his hold on power was. The attacks against the Jadids reached fever pitch during the Second Uzbekistan Conference of Cultural Workers in October 1927. Ikramov attacked Vadud Mahmud, the jerk who said that Jesuits didn't exist, and that their language is useless, for being a nationalist. He riled the crowd up until they shouted, "Enough! Away with the people! Vadud get lost!" until Vadud left. Botu, a young communist, wrote, quote, "Red cultural workers of Uzbekistan shamed an opponent of proletarian ideology and kicked him out of their midst." And both quotes are from Making Uzbekistan by Adib Khalid. By 1926, the European communists had a stranglehold on local press, and they used their reporters to spread communism and be the frontline soldiers in their battles against the Jadids. These correspondents were often beaten, threatened, and sometimes killed for their work, but the Soviets did their best to protect them, even making it illegal to reveal the identity of these correspondents. The Central Asian Bureau purged books they deemed harmful and discussed finally closing the muktabs and madrasas for good. They placed their own hand-picked workers into the position of editors in several newspapers and slowly exerted control over what was and wasn't published. Any desire to talk about Central Asia's unique position, needs, and development were overwritten with a universal and Russian-centric version of the October Revolution. The true revolution arrived in Central Asia when the Tashkent Soviet took over Tashkent. Never mind the disaster that that experiment was. By doing this, the Soviets could persecute people for lacking proletariat credentials in a society without proletariats. Any attempt to center the work of the local actors was deemed as nationalist. Instead, one had to acknowledge the good work of the Russians who brought communism and salvation with them. On the literary front, there was a new crop of writers who spoke communists better than their own counterparts. Like the young communists, they saw themselves as the true guardians of communism. Some, like Ghafur Ghulam, Oybek, and Hamid Olumjan, had become the fathers of Soviet Union literature in Central Asia. Others, such as Botu and Ziyo Sid, were purged but remembered, while others, such as Kwamshinbek, Akwaboy, and Amala Jonim, the first woman prose writer in Uzbek, have been almost forgotten. Some of these new Soviet writers had been taught by Jadids and may have been on friendly terms with them before the Soviet Union made it clear that to prove oneself a communist, one had to destroy the nationalists. Botu, in particular, had a very violent break from the Jadids, attacking Chopin in public, proclaiming, quote, "You are a slave to yourself. I am my own force. I visit your thoughts, your dreams, and non-existence. You plan against light. Your cause is hollow. My cause commands fighting your cause." Quote is from Adib Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. He further argued that the Jadids were confined to the limits of madrasa literature, and after the revolution, quote, continued to fill the minds of school children with the poison of homeland and nation. People loved to attack Chopin, actually. If it wasn't Fitchat, it was Chopin. Olim Sharafidinov, a member of the new literary class, once wrote, quote, "Who is Chopin? Whose poet is he? Chopin is a poet of the nationalist, patriotic, pessimistic intelligentsia. His ideology is the ideology of this group." He argued that Chopin saw all Russians as colonizers and blamed them for, quote, "all wretchedness afflicting Uzbekistan." Uzmanjan Eshanjojev, a childhood friend of Chopin, piled on, adding, quote, "The defect and harmfulness of Chopin's poetry lies in its ideology, which from the point of view of our time is reactionary. The poet is an idealist and an individualist, and therefore sees every political and social event not from the side of the masses, but from his own personal point of view." And all of those quotes are from Adib Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. The Alash Order in Kazakhstan weren't faring any better. Uraz Izev, a European communist, argued that the Alash Orda were really the beginning of a bourgeoisie class in Kazakhstan and attacked them for siding with the White Army, quote, "the most inveterate enemies of the revolution." And quote is from Maria Blackwood's article, Personal Experiences of Nationality and Power in Soviet Kazakhstan, 1917-1953. Izev further argued that, "We should not think that former Alash Ordists represent a stiff and indivisible whole. There are some incorrigible political hunchbacks who will only be reformed by the grave. but there's also a certain segment of young people who were not especially active in Alash Orda in the past, who under the influence of our positive work have noticeably changed their convictions. Such people must be more closely drawn into Soviet work and given the opportunity to more actively cooperate with us. Quote is from Maria Blackwood's article, Personal Experiences. While the goal was to try and rehabilitate those who had fallen from communist ideals, it was far more important to root out those who were using communism to advance their own goals. He wrote, quote, such elements entered our party either because they have the wrong address or because they want to use the party in their own interest. Such elements should be decisively removed from the party ranks. Quote is from Maria Blackwood's article, Personal Experiences. Two of these elements were Alekhine Butyhanov and Akhmet Batursunov. Alekhine was banished to Moscow in 1923, but he was able to travel back and forth from 1923 to 1924, participating in scientific conferences, expeditions, and research. Despite his best efforts, he never managed to earn a permanent position within Kazakhstan. He was arrested several times between 1923 and the time of his death, July 1937. Akhmet Batursunov would serve in several academic positions, mostly in Kazakhstan and Siberia, before being arrested for the first time in June 2, 1929. He was held in Butyrsky prison until Maxim Gorky's wife intervened and petitioned for his release. He would be arrested again in 1937 and executed along with several other Jadids and Alash Orda members. Part 1b, Tactics to Survive the Onslaught. For the poor Jadids, there weren't many options to escape these attacks. Some retreated in scholarly work, others tried to recreate themselves in order to continue doing public work, and others made public statements of repentance and loyalty. Fitchat wrote a play in support of the land reform being carried out, and Chopin wrote a letter to the Second Congress of Culture Workers, admitting he had had nationalist feelings in the past and promised to rectify his mistakes. Kodiri retreated to fiction writing that was published despite being acknowledged as not Soviet enough, while others tried to write Soviet-only novels. Poor Elbek, another Jadid, was arrested by the OGPU in 1927 and was asked to write testimony about non-Soviet actors, Jadids, and nationalists in Uzbekistan. Munavar Khori, who the Soviets hated, spoke at a conference of cultural workers in 1927, admitting his mistakes, and argued that many people who held power in the party were taught by the Jadids. He said, over the course of 30 years, we could not carry out land reform and unveiling. The Bolshevik Party has accomplished these in 10 years. We are ready to support the revolution. One or two Jadids have sinned, but it is not good to tar all of them with the same brush. Quote is from Making Uzbekistan by Adib Talib. Munavar's plea was met with mockery, and he never made a public appearance again. Others adopted a strategy of learned helplessness. In her book, Despite Cultures, Kesembekova argues that when the Soviets complained about Central Asian quote-unquote backwardness, or inability to implement and support Soviet goals, they were identifying a coping mechanism many people utilized to survive the upheaval that followed the Russian Revolution. If the Soviets could complain that Central Asians simply didn't understand communism or were purposely trying progress, the Central Asians could claim that the Soviets had failed to teach them properly. One time, an Iranian communist who was sent to Tajikistan to help with the Soviet program apologized for his missteps, claiming, quote, I think that I have many defects, a lot of mistakes, a lot of misunderstanding, which need to be re-educated. A Tajik communist reportedly replied, too many defects will not do. A little bit is okay. Quote is from Botikoz Kasimbekova's book, Despite Cultures. Part 2. Living Within a Soviet Society. Kasimbekova makes a fascinating argument in her book, Despite Cultures, that the only way the Soviets could unite all their republics was to create the language of bureaucracy. This, however, was a stupefying, alienating language that many people simply couldn't understand, and thus it became a tool to obfuscate and condemn. Kasimbekova argues that early communism depended on individual party members who were dedicated to communist principles. These individuals needed to embody these principles 100% with the utmost purity. They had to have a complete understanding of communism and the Politburo's goals, and be able to identify the true roots of inequality. They were not bound by law or language, because those were the tools of capitalism, and thus it was okay to tell a lie if it furthered the communist project. It was okay it was okay to work with class traitors for a while because it helped communism. It was action that proved true. If a lie saved communism, then it was a pure act. If a lie hurt communism, then it was punished. The reliance on individual cadres allowed Soviets to claim they were anti-colonial and anti-capitalist, which relied on institutions. This strategy was cheaper than building institutions from the ground up. It enabled mass-scale campaigns, since communism depended on all individuals coming together for the greater good, and if an individual resisted, he was identified as a threat and treated accordingly. It allowed deputized individuals to spread throughout the whole terrain and bring communism to the most remote of villages. However, it also made communism dependent on local actors on the ground. A leader could get away with a lot as long as they kept up with agricultural and industrial demands. This also meant that communism wasn't implemented consistently and left a wide range of experiences within the communist system. The Soviet leaders were idealized and had tremendous power, but were constantly hounded and spied on to ensure they remained pure. This taught local leaders to speak Bolshevik to upper party leaders while pursuing whatever policies they wanted on the ground. For many people in Central Asia, this meant learning the language while utilizing the Bolsheviks' assumption of backwardness to their favor. This meant that words were no longer used as means of communication. Violence was. If the Soviets didn't like something, they violently punished the perpetrators. But that also meant guessing which crime someone was killed for, so no one was ever sure what Moscow really wanted and what it really detested. Part 2A, Disgruntlement with the Soviet Order. Of course, attacking nationalism right after a nation had been created was counterproductive, and the Soviets couldn't ignore the persistence of colonial inequalities and ethnic division in the region. The lack of a local proletariat and the increase of fascination with having a nation led the OGPU to become obsessed with the rise of quote-unquote pan-Uzbekism and chauvinism. Europeans continued to stream into Central Asia looking for work. Many of the economic sectors were dominated by Europeans, and the Soviets with power and trust of the OGPU were the Europeans. This led to quiet disgruntlement with the failing of the new order. Some of the complaints the OGPU recorded were as follows. Quote, the Russians are conducting a chauvinist policy. In Kashkent, all factories are packed with Russians. If an Uzbek ends up there, he is fired right away. Another quote. Ferghana's peasantry is in a very difficult situation. Colonists command everything. The situation is so catastrophic that one may expect an uprising. The line of the CC in regard to the intellectual is incorrect, and the struggle with colonizers is conducted indecisively. Both quotes are from Abdul Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. Worst of all were the whispers that because of the forced production of cotton, Uzbekistan had become nothing more than a red colony like India or Egypt under British rule. A teacher in Kashkent told his students that Uzbekistan was, quote, in fact, a colony that exports cotton as a raw material. One student asked, quote, what is the difference between the English colony of India and the administration of Kazakhstan by Golashchekin? And both quotes are from Adi Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. A Kazakh official once called the Bolsheviks, quote-unquote, colonizers with party cards, because they never understood the local needs. They only pushed what they thought the region needed. Sobir Kuldarov, an accused member of a nationalist counter-revolutionary organization, wrote, quote, the nationalist policy of Soviet power in Uzbekistan we regard as colonial policy, as a continuation of the great power policies of Tsarism. Such a policy in reality provides for the well-being exclusively of the Russian nation at the expense of the exploitation of the indigenous population. Thus, for example, Europeans living in Uzbekistan find themselves in the most favorable situations when the Uzbek part of the population is doomed to the most pitiable beggarly existence. We consider that Uzbekistan has enough natural wealth and commodity production for it to be an independent economic unit and consequently to have its own industry, both light and heavy. We consider the Soviet power wittingly does not allow the development of independent industry in Uzbekistan exclusively because it seeks to keep Uzbekistan as a base for raw materials in order to extort its riches. In other words, Uzbekistan is a colony of Inner Russia, supplying raw material for its industry. End quote is from Adib Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. In 1929, Yegor Sodikov, a party member from Kuzhan, wrote to Stalin directly, quoting, peasants and artisans endure deprivation. They cannot complain, for they are afraid of arrest by the OGPU, but the cup of the peasantry's patience is filled to the brim. Waiting until it flows over is harmful. If the leadership of the party does not change and the people continue to be despised, then without regard to my 12 years of work and the loss of my health in this work, I would consider myself to have left the party. Quote is from Making Uzbekistan by Adib Khalid. Things were similarly dire in Tajikistan, who had to deal with a weak infrastructure and government apparatus and constant basmachi incursions. And you can learn about the basmachi in our last episode. Their government was made out of communists who were either in Tajikistan as a form of punishment or had nowhere else to go. The basmachi and questionable communists drew a large number of OGPU into the region. Many officials actually wanted to leave Tajikistan, but the Soviets made it impossible to resettle. When that failed, the presence of the OGPU was enough to keep people in line. The OGPU were above the local government's power, and this upset many officials. Two Soviet members in Tajikistan complained that, quote, "We have no authority. Our secret communication is being opened by the OGPU. Our telegrams are not being sent. There's war against the Revolutionary Committee. You should either help us or remove us from Tajikistan." The OGPU acted like cops always do. One time they kept an eyewitness prisoner for 7 months. Another time a party member received several complaints about an OGPU member who, quote, "pushed peasants off the road. They were half-dressed and half-shod, with donkeys stuck in the mud up to their ears. I.e., you surely know what kind of roads are here in winter." Moreover, he stopped at the mosque and raped a woman who was heading to a first aid post. The peasants saw this and were shocked, and I have an eyewitness, the chief investigator. Does this not discredit the authority of the party and branches of the OGPU? Both quotes are from Butikov's Kasimbekova's book, Despite Cultures. It is hard to tell how widespread this dissatisfaction was, but it made the Soviets paranoid, leading to a massive purge in 1929. Part 3. Destroying Islam. For years, the Soviets uncomfortably tolerated Islam because they were afraid of sparking a mass exodus to the Basmachi ranks. But by 1926, they implemented a new initiative to untie society and culture from Islam. In 1927, the Soviets officially closed all maktabs in the Central Asian states. However, the Soviet schools were not increased to handle the 35,000-plus new students, and so many kids simply went without an education. After dealing with the maktabs, they went after the madrasas, finalizing the nationalization of wakf land and cannibalizing the buildings for other purposes. Those they could not repurpose, they closed by 1928. The Soviets also turned on the quote-unquote progressive ulama who they had relied on in the early 1920s to help spread support of the Soviet reign. The OGPU worried that, to quote a report from the Kazakhstan Central Committee, "Today's clergy is not the clergy of 5 or 10 years ago. It is a clergy that understands the moment of the struggle of labor of capital, of socialism with capitalism, going on in the country where socialism is being built, and adapts all its tactics to the current movement." Quote is from Adib Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. Basically, by educating the ulama about communism, they actually made the ulama more powerful and dangerous. To counter their dangerous influence, the Soviets abolished the quasi-courts and the Sharia administrations in 1927. They increased rhetoric that placed all of the blame for the violence of the civil war on the ulama, even the reformist or progressive ulama, and the basmachi. The Soviets argued that the basmachi and ulama were united against the people of Central Asia, and thus absolved all Soviets and Europeans of violence they definitely committed. While the committee's executive were concerned with the maktabs and madrasas, lower-level communists turned their attention to the mosques and shrines. This movement gathered considerable support among the local Soviets, forcing the central committees to support them or be called counter-revolutionary. The secretary of the Bukhara Party Committee wrote, quote, "Mosques were closed by decisions of party cells, by decisions of Komsomol cells, by decisions of rule of Soviets, of meetings of the poor, or simply without any decision at all. Such an abominable situation continued from the beginning of 1927 to the end of 1928. The closing of mosques took on the character of a competition." Quote is from Making Uzbekistan by Abdul Khalid. Because this was led from the ground up, the closures were not as sudden or as effective as the closures of the maktabs or madrasas. When the Soviets couldn't destroy a mosque, they repurposed them into clubs, red reading rooms, warehouses, schools, or stables for OGPU horses. The mosque closed in spurts between 1927 and 1929, and it picked up again in the 30s as it became part of the collectivization efforts. Part 3A, Shohimmadon. Great violence could occur when the Soviets tried to destroy the mosques and shrines. One of the most famous examples was in March 1929 in the mountain village Shohimmadon in the Fergana Valley. Jadid playwright Hamza Hakimzoda Niyazov was overseeing the destruction of the Mazar attributed to Ali Muhammad's son-in-law. The caretakers of the Mazar were dozens of families of Shiites and Zojas. Hamza wanted to convert the Mazar into a resort for the poor peasants. He argued that the site was corrupt, claiming, quote, "The Zojas in the hamlet of Shohimmadon have turned the fake grave of Ali into a resource, and they rob the people with it. The Shiites claim to have the key to paradise in their hands because of their descent from Hassan and Hussein. They send those who do the proper sacrifice and to pay the Shiites to quote-unquote paradise, and those who don't to quote-unquote hell. These Shiites of Shohimmadon have to this day never worked, never labored, but dressed in the garb of cunning, they have adopted the principles of Satan, and turning their rosaries have fattened the pigs of the Shohimmadon steppe. They have poisoned the minds of workers with superstition, and now feed off of their possessions." Quote is from Making Uzbekistan by Adib Khalid. Hamza brought with him several peasants to march on the Mazar, place a red flag on his kopala, and padlock the door. He also established a red tea house and kiln, hiring 35 families to run the site and to crowd out the Zojas. He threatened to call the Red Army unless the Shiites publicly announced that they were indeed corrupt and feeding off the people and their misplaced faith. The standoff lasted throughout the winter of 1928 until in early March, on the evening of the end of Ramadan, Soviet police entered the mosque, took off the wall hangings, and arrested the muezzin. On March 17th, the demolition began. A crowd of 300 people defended the shrine, disarmed the police, destroyed the red tea house, and stoned Hamza to death. The OGPU arrested 54 people and put them on public trial in June. 9 were executed, 16 sentenced to prison, 25 exiled to other parts of the Soviet Union, and 4 were acquitted. Despite the fact that the Soviets were anti-clerical and anti-religious, the OGPU, of all people, noticed that the closing of mosques was causing too much disruption. They asked the Central Committee to try and quell the closing of mosques. Even Akmal Ikrimov said, quote, "As it is, nowhere does the population trust Soviet power. If someone wants there to be an uprising in Uzbekistan, then a few more such abominable acts will be enough." Like the hujum, the unveiling of women, the closing of mosques was constructed without taking the local population in consideration. It quickly spiraled out of control because it was left to the lower ranks of the Soviet apparatus, and once it spiraled out of control, it created flashpoints for people who were already upset with the Soviet regime to violently vent their frustration and anger. Part 4. Collectivization. While the Soviets were trying to slow down the hujum and closing of mosques in 1929, they implemented maybe the most disruptive policy, collectivization. This policy was designed to establish Soviet control over the countryside and break all resistance. It would produce great violence and mass starvation. The same collectivization effort would create the Holodomor in Ukraine in 1930. And while Ukraine suffered the most in terms of the number of dead, the suffering in Kazakhstan specifically shouldn't be underestimated. To give you a sense of perspective, the conservative estimate is that 3.9 million people died in the Holodomor. And the conservative estimate is that 1.5 to 2 million people died during the Kazakh famine. It's estimated 30 to 40% of all Kazakhs died. The Holodomor and the starvation of the Kazakhs was genocide. The goal of collectivization was to collect individually owned farmlands and livestock into collective holdings controlled by the state. The idea was that the state would most effectively decide how the food should be distributed, and you wouldn't have pesky price gouging or shortages because the state, i.e. Stalin, was all-knowing and never got anything wrong. Turning Central Asia into an agricultural dispensary came out of the pain of the Russian Empire collapsing and Moscow losing access to food in Ukraine, Central Asia, and the Caucasus. It was also a matter of self-sufficiency. If the Soviets could grow their own cotton, they wouldn't have to import so much. Cotton made up one-third of all the values of all imports in 1924, and enabled them to export more textiles, creating jobs in Russia proper. Central Asia, especially Kazakhstan, accounted for 75% of the Soviet Union's domestic cotton supply, but it had never hoped to meet the Soviet Union's needs. The Soviets were importing 45% of their cotton fiber, meaning it made up 15% of all imports between 1924 and 1928. The world prices for cotton fluctuated widely, inspiring Stalin's desire of cotton independence. To increase cotton production, the Soviets fixed the purchase price of cotton to 2.5 and then 3 times the market price of grain from 1922 to 1926. Many Central Asian farmers and peasants took advantage of the lucrative prices, increasing cotton acreage from 171,255 acres in 1922 to 1,412,915 acres in 1926. The Soviets further encouraged cotton growth by offering various forms of aid, such as agricultural credits, subsidies, farming implements, draft animals, and land improvement aid. In 1928, the Komsomol even went so far as to create cotton holidays, declaring cotton as a key component of Uzbek honor, and cotton became the symbol of Uzbekistan. In Tajikistan, cotton was identified as its pride and glory, quote, the happiness and hope of the Soviet Union, and, quote, the measure of the Republic's achievement and successes, end quotes, are from Otakos Kasimbekova's book, Despite Cultures. A Soviet official described Tajikistan's role in growing cotton as, quote, the Tajik SSR is a wonderful illustration of the Comintern thesis about the possibility of non-capitalist development in the world's most backward countries under the leadership of the proletariat. Who does not understand that the Soviet Asian republics, including Tajikistan, already became inseparable parts of what one whole economic system of the Soviet Union, and that they have particular functions in the industrialization of the USSR. The cotton program in this regard is a program of union industrialization and socialist Kishlak village rebuilding. The union's industry does not only receive cotton from Tajikistan, it also gives powerful support to the development of industrial capacity, increases material support, and raises cultural awareness for the sprawling masses of the working peasants. There is obviously a dual relation. Those who do not understand the duality of the relationship understand nothing. They devolve from our national policy either as great imperial chauvinists or local nationalists. End quote is from Votikos Kasimbekova's book, Despite Cultures. Cotton was the ultimate status of achieving Sovietization, of having a culture, of being part of a bigger whole, and avoiding conquest by other European powers who would abuse the Tajiks, unlike the Soviets, of course. Despite the desperate need for cotton, the Soviets' policies were costly because it required the Soviet Union to ship enough grain in Central Asia to make up for the grain the region wasn't producing. This meant that the Soviet Union was diverting grain from exporting it to world markets to feed its own people internally, increasing their trade deficit. However, many found the quality of grain and wheat to be terrible. Central Asians bought locally grown grain instead, which prevented the government from recouping some of its losses and took land away from growing cotton. The cherry on the miserable sundae was that despite all these benefits and aid, cotton growth itself didn't improve. It never met their yield before the revolution, falling below the 80% goal. Predictably, the focus on cotton created massive food shortages in the cotton-producing districts, which culminated in the terrible famine of the 1930s. Areas that had formerly been able to feed themselves faced starvation as prices skyrocketed and grain shortages increased. For example, in January 1928, a year before collectivization was ever put in place, Uzbekistan was supposed to receive 3.8 million pods of grain from Russia. They only received 40%. These shortages would grow to include most household items by 1930. To make up for the lack of grain, the Soviets implemented the policy of quote-unquote import substitution in 1927. The idea was to look for ways to import food from regions within Central Asia where it was impossible to grow cotton. This included transporting livestock from non-cotton regions to cotton regions, leaving the people who lived in non-cotton regions at an even greater risk of starvation. So they were stealing food from people who were starving to feed people who were starving. It was these regions, not the cotton-producing regions, that suffered the worst during the 1930s famine. Peasants of all strata came together to demand the reversal of new obligation and taxes, the release of those who had been arrested while protesting, the end of the cotton program, and permission to quote-unquote live according to the Sharia. When that didn't work, they turned to the Basmachi, briefly resurrecting the failing guerrilla movement, and you can learn more about that in our last episode. Other armed resistant movements cropped up in Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan, and even local communists resisted collectivization. In 1925, 30 Kazakh officials signed a letter protesting their exclusion from making any decisions regarding their own state. In 1927, Mahmud Tumilov, a Turkmen official, publicly attacked the Economic Council for robbing the national republics of their economic autonomy. 44 prominent Kazakh intellectuals were arrested in 1928 for opposing Filip Golashekin's, the European Party Secretary of Kazakhstan, plan to forcibly settle nomadic Kazakhs in order to promote grain cultivation. When resistance failed, people simply left, fleeing to Afghanistan, Iran, and Xinjiang, as long as the borders were open. However, Soviet, and in Xinjiang's case, China, Chinese pressure, forced these states to close their borders, and then there was no escape. Collectivization was not a success because farmers didn't understand it. It artificially cut their prices in half. They preferred to eat their cattle and sell what remained. The Moscow administration didn't offer any clear idea what a collective farm should look like or how it should operate, and so the peasants panicked, wanting to save as much of their property as possible. Kazakhstan, in particular, was already hard hit by the confiscations that were meant to starve the Basmachi. Collectivization seemed to guarantee that everyone else would starve as well. The Soviets turned to violence, especially as the local party leaders failed to meet five-year goals, and they were being accused of not being loyal communists by higher-ups. 1929 to 1930, the Tajikistan Central Executive Committee planned to collectivize 16,000 households. By April 1930, a party newspaper reported that 98% of the collectivization plans were fulfilled. Yet members in the know reported that Tajikistan had only filled 40% of the plan because of Basmachi disturbances. The Tajik Executive Committee decided in 1930 to change plans and created TOZAs, or associations for the joint collectivization of land, not the collectivization of cattle and tools. So, in like Ukraine and other places, the Soviets were collectivizing land, tools, livestock, but in Tajikistan, the Soviets like, no, we're just going to collectivize the land. You can keep your tools and your livestock. In 1931, 20 to 25% of all grain and 50% of cotton sowing lands were turned into TOZAs. By 1932, this increased to 41.9%, and by 1937, 98.3% of all land was reported as collectivized. Part 4A, Collectivization, a Test for European Communists. Collectivization was not only tamed the indigenous actors, but it also tested the European communist leaders, allowing them to prove themselves as true communists or as counter-revolutionaries. For Central Asia, this put Shirin Shadents and Karl Baumann, the leaders of the Central Asian Bureau, and Davud Usinov, the secretary for Tajikistan, in a tough place. Shadents was in charge of supervising the cotton cultivation of 1929 to 1930 and was responsible for the anti-Basmachi campaign that led to the capture of Ibrahim Beck. Usinov was eventually recalled from Tajikistan for his quote-unquote failure, and Shadents would replace him after the Central Asian Bureau was eliminated. While Shadents was in charge of the cotton industry in Central Asia, Baumann was in charge of collectivization. Both of these men had questionable histories of nationalism, which is why Stalin sent them to Tajikistan. It was an easy way to get them to prove themselves to him. However, the pressure of meeting impossible goals while being hounded by the OGPU members broke many Soviet officials, as this conversation between Shadents and Usinov reveals. Quote, I just arrived from Kurgan Tube, and I feel terrible. I can hardly drag myself to the telephone. According to the information of May 25th, on the basis of the last directive from Baumann, 6,000 metric tons of grain must be delivered by July 15th. We now have 2,900 metric hundredweights. I am sure we will fulfill the plan. Undivided attention is paid to Garm. There we will send our camels and take further measures. Kajit OGPU chief Dorofiev is in Garm, one Central Committee brigade. Five OGPU people are also heading there. According to their information, we already collected 2,200 metric hundred weights of grain. We are thinking of bringing all our cars there from Stalinabad, which is modern-day Dushanbe. What's new? What's going on in Moscow? How is your health? Koba? Sergo? I have to inform you that there's no way I can leave Stalinabad and come to Tashkent. I need, frankly speaking, a holiday. I just physically cannot move. I insistently asked you to delay my report in Tashkent for at least 2 to 3 days, better 7 days. I repeat that I am unable to move from this place. End quote is from Botikov's Kasimbekova's book, Despite Cultures. As we can see from the quote, Dusanov was not a strong man in control of the situation in Tajikistan. He was a tired and sick man surrounded by the OGPU, who are interested in forcing local peasants to give up their food, as they were in turning on failing communists. For an ideology that is supposed to put the community first, the application of collectivization was a very individualized affair. The local leaders were held personally responsible for failures, even in places like Tajikistan, which wasn't ever going to meet its grain requirements because of its landscape and raids from Bismachi. Yet when Bauman reported the failure of the 1931 Central Asian Cotton Campaign to Stalin, he knew he would be held personally responsible. He wrote, quote, "I want to warn you and the Central Committee that we will not be able to fulfill the plan, and I do not want to appear before you as someone whitewashing the situation. Unconditionally, there are masses of failure and mistakes in our work, but I firmly declare that I took up the struggle to the best of my abilities, and I lost on the front with a clear conscience. Please let me continue my work in Central Asia for a couple more years, and I think I will justify your trust and help the party in its struggle for cotton." Quote is from Botikov's Kasimbekova's book, Despite Cultures. The 5-year plan was completely disconnected from reality, making it hard for local leaders to meet their goals. The peasant often asked the Soviets where they were supposed to plant their grain, as they had no arable land, and the Soviets would reply, quote, "Sow anywhere you want, even in your huts," end quote. "You have no soil on your breast, but your hair is thick enough. You can sow the seeds there, just fulfill the plan." Quotes are from Botikov's Kasimbekova's book, Despite Cultures. The forced stealing of food left many people, including Soviet officials, starving and were unable to work, even though they were forced to by the secret police. The Soviet police often went months without pay, and when that happened, they joined the wandering bands of guerrillas and warlords, leaving Soviet officials unprotected. The peasants led revolts when they could, and sometimes managed to kill local Soviet officials. These miserable conditions led to severe alcoholism and abuse on part of the European Soviets. Rape was frequent, and even though the Soviets found people to scapegoat for the most excessive acts of violence, it was part of the plan. What the peasants wouldn't give up willingly would be taken by force. Part 5. The Murder of the Central Asian Intelligentsia. 1929 was a year of great change in Central Asia. Tajikistan was elevated to a full republic. Stalin proclaimed the year as the, quote, "year of the great breakthrough," and the attacks against the old intelligentsia in Central Asia intensified to new heights. From 1929 to 1931, the Soviet apparatus would purge the indigenous ranks, leaving no other alternative to Soviet power. Part 5A, the OGPU craft a conspiracy. With collectivization came resistance and failures, meaning that the Soviets needed scapegoats to explain why Stalin's quote-unquote great 5-year plan and genocides weren't achieving the results he expected. For the OGPU in Central Asia, the obvious solution was to uncover a nationalistic counter-revolutionary conspiracy amongst the Central Asian intellectuals. People like Fitchat, Zhozhev, and Bukhinov only pretended to convert to communism so they could use Soviet resources to create a bourgeoisie nationalist state that they would then betray to the English for some reason. As one OGPU agent wrote, quote, "Materials in our possession indicate the 1929, especially its second half, characterized not just by the general growth of anti-Soviet manifestations of the Bais in the countryside, but also the growth in the activity of nationalist counter-revolutionary forces, including a significant rearrangement of forces also among the national intelligentsia." Quote is from Abdi Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. The conspiracy began with an article titled, quote, "The Bark of the Chain Dogs of the Khan of Kokan," by L. Rajasthan. L. Rajasthan would be the future writer of the Soviet National Anthem of 1943. He attacked the Soviet State Publishing House for financial irregularities and for publishing chauvinistic, nationalistic, anti-Soviet works. The Uzbek State Publishing House was directed by Hadi Fazi, who had been a member of the Soviet boogeyman, the Kokon Autonomy. When the article wasn't attacking Fazi, it attacked Chopin. El Rajistan calls Chopin, quote, a prostitute of the pen and a stoker of chauvinism, whose anti-Soviet songs were sung, quote, in chorus by Basmachi's taken prisoner. And all quotes are from Abdi Khali's book, Making Uzbekistan. Chopin defended himself by claiming, quote, it is an old matter for which I was abused plenty then. Now it is necessary to abuse me for new misdeeds, if there are any. Quote is from Adi Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. Other attacked El Rajistan for being a chauvinist and in the pocket of other ultra-nationalists such as Ramzi, Botu, and Fitchat. The deeds weren't the only, quote, snakes in the grass. The Soviets in Kazakhstan attacked the Alash Order just as viciously, claiming, quote, the Alash Party set itself the task of collectively joining the party, just thus hiding behind their party cards in order to defend their work. They joined the Soviets only so that they could use legal forms to fracture the Soviet apparatus and use it for their own goals as buys. And this quote is from Mary Blackwood's article, Personal Experiences of Nationality and Power in Soviet Kazakhstan, 1917-1953. On November 6th, 1929, the OGPU arrested several alleged members of the Committee of National Independence. One of the people arrested was Munavar Khori, a Jadid who had been under surveillance for a long time because of his association with Zet Validi Khodan and his quote-unquote mismanagement of the WAC office. Munavar was accused of, quote, having preserved an irreconcilable enmity to Soviet power. He continued to group around himself the counter-revolutionary element of the bourgeoisie intelligentsia, conducted systematic anti-Soviet propaganda, in particular among the student youth, and having conducted espionage work on the instructions of Afghan diplomats. Quote is from Adi Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. The OGPU expanded their arrest from Tashkent to Namagan, where they arrested several other people, including the staff of New Fargana, where Hamza had been a contributor, before being stoned to death. Based on the activities of the New Fargana staff, the OGPU created another secret counter-revolutionary organization called the Botir Gapchular, which consisted of 13 formal members. The OGPU claimed, quote, during the short three-month period, it had strengthened organizationally, worked out programmatic and tactical arrangements, and determined its most immediate goals. Not bad for an organization that didn't exist. End quote is from Adi Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. In February 1930, the OGPU expanded their reach once more and arrested Sadullah Kosimov, the head of the chief court of Uzbekistan, and placed him on trial for corruption and using, quote, Soviet institutions and his position in the interests of the enemy class. During the trial, it, quote, became clear that Kosimov was part of a carefully planned nationalistic plot. He was involved with Baiz, Ulema, and a pan-Turkish organization in Tashkent, led by none other than Munavar Khori. Kosimov was charged with planting the organization's agents in every Soviet institution and wreck it from the inside. And all the quotes are from Adi Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. Poor Kosimov was executed in June, but the chief witness for the prosecution, Obid Sadov, fell ill during dinner and died on June 23, 1930. The OGPU investigated his death and discovered he was poisoned. The OGPU took this as evidence of a grand plot and arrested Obid's brother, Nozir, who confessed he was in on the plot that had been ordered by Botu. So, Kosimov was part of a plot that was associated with Munavar's group. He was part of a plot that was associated with a pan-Turkish group. He was part of a plot that was part of Botu's group. And they were all different groups, and they were all planning to overthrow the Soviet Union. The OGPU, quote-unquote, discovered that Botu was part of the Milli Istiqlal. Botu supposedly claimed that the goal of the organization was, quote, the achievement of the independence of Uzbekistan in the form of a separate bourgeoisie democratic republic. He supposedly claimed that, quote, it is necessary to think not only of the present, but also of the future. He told Nozir Sadov that, quote, our Uzbek petty bourgeoisie youth is in a very straitened condition. It's booted from schools and the Soviet apparatus. In our thinking about education, we pay very little attention to the preservation in the youth of national feeling. Meanwhile, in the future, i.e., upon Uzbekistan's secession from the USSR, we will need cadres of nationalist youth. It is necessary to strengthen the nationalist reworking of the youth through the school and literature. End quote is from Abdi Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan. Botu was arrested on July 23, 1930. More arrests followed, and the OGPU made up another counter-revolutionary organization. So this is the third one, not including Validi's organization, called Union of Enthusiasts. This group had infiltrated Uzbekistan's Narkompros, proving that there was a conspiracy to destroy the Soviet Union from the inside out. None of the people arrested were given show trials. Instead, they were shipped to Moscow to be interrogated in Butyrka prison. In total, 87 people were arrested and 15 were sentenced to death on April 23, 1931. Munavar Khori was executed immediately, but others had their sentence changed from death to death at a labor camp instead. Botu would spend 1931 to 1933 being shipped from prison to prison until he was formally sentenced to 10 years in a labor camp on Solovetsky Islands in the Arctic. He would spend 5 years there before being recalled and shot during the Great Terror. Over the decade, the OGPU, later turned into the NKVD, found similar secret societies in Tajikistan and in Turkmenistan. While this first wave of arrests spared many Jadids, the verbal assaults increased in their ferocity. Jali Boybolatov, a Czechist who had been tracking Fitrat's since the Bukharan People's Soviet Republic, wrote a detailed attack on Fitrat's entire catalog, claiming he was a chauvinist and nationalist, and attacked Chadataism as being a nationalist ideology. Fitrat defended himself. It was the last time he'd be published in the newspaper, but the die was cast. No longer were indigenous actors able to debate the future of their forming nations in the newspapers. They were officially iced out, and only communist-approved thought could appear in the papers. It's not 100% clear why Fitrat, Chopin, and Khodiri survived the arrests of 1929 to 1930. Adib Khalid postulates that it may have been because of Fethullah Gulen's protection, although there isn't any real documentary proof that that was the case, and there might never be. It could have been because they were easy lightning rods and scapegoats that others to trip over themselves attacking to prove their own communist credentials, and so the OGPU didn't yet see a reason to get rid of them. Better to use them to turn indigenous intellectuals against each other, fundamentally breaking all bonds of social and cultural ties before killing everyone. A favorite Soviet game. Part 5b, Scapegoats in Tajikistan. By 1933, the Soviet machine needed scapegoats to explain the failure of collectivization and cotton growing in Tajikistan. After a year of interrogations, recrimination, investigations, and paranoia, the OGPU selected Nusratullah Maksum of the Central Executive Committee and Abdurakhim Zojabev of the Council of People's Commissars to be the sacrificial lambs. They were accused of being part of counter-revolutionary organizations aiming to eliminate Soviet rule in Tajikistan. The OGPU arrested 600 people for being connected to Maksum and Zojabev's plot, many of whom had been Jadids transplanted from Uzbekistan to Tajikistan. One such Jadid was Abdul Tadir Mukhitdinov, who became the Tajik Fitrat or Munavar Khori. He was attacked for being a Jadid, for distrusting the five-year plan, for being a wealthy merchant who had made money from cotton in the past. Mukhitdinov was in charge of collectivization, and his letters fell into OGBTU hands. In one letter, he asked Karl Baumann to confiscate only cotton, not cattle, so the people would not starve. Another local party member said Mukhitdinov asked him not to press grain collection and to keep as much grain for the people. He claimed that Mukhitdinov said, we made the revolution, but we destroyed ourselves. We Muslims are not united. We try to eat each other and destroy ourselves. Russians are united, but we report on each other and hence destroyed the Bukharan People's Socialist Republic. quote is from Botico's Kasim Batova's book, Despite Cultures. Mukhitdinov was purged from the party and executed in 1934. At first, Bauman and Gusanov tried to protect Matsum and Zojiviv, but by December 1933, they turned their backs on the publicly, Matsum and Zojiviv were accused of being counter-revolutionaries, but the OGP records revealed conflicting accusations depending on who they spoke with. Either Matsum and Zojiviv were too extreme in fulfilling the Soviet plan, or they did too much to help the peasants resist collectivization. There is also an intriguing claim that Matsum and Zojiviv attacked the OGPU for driving people into the arms of the Basmachi and for getting in the way of collectivization. So this could have been a personal vendetta on the part of the OGPU. Frustrated with the OGPU and the situation in Tajikistan, one of them warned another Soviet member, you worked for Soviet rule, you got medals, but now you can throw them away. You will not be thanked for your work. You will be arrested. Quote is from Botikov's Kasim Batova's book, Despite Cultures. Surprisingly, neither were executed. Instead, they were transferred to different positions and then Moscow. Gusanov was also dismissed from his post between 1933 to 1934. The Central Asian Bureau sent 105 new workers to Tajikistan and then dozens of new secret police agents. Abdullah Rakhimbev replaced Zojiviv. He actually was involved in the delimitation between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and actually argued against the creation of Tajikistan. Grigory Boydo replaced Gusanov. Boydo was involved in the Sovietization of Central Asia back in 1917 and played a key role in the formation of the Bukharan and Kievan Communist Parties and led a Kievan military campaign. Earned by Asharov was sent to support Brodo. Shirvanshoh Shotimur, who had worked with Matsum and Zojiviv, was in charge of the purges of Tajikistan. With the exception of Shotimur, all of these new leaders were outsiders brought in because they needed a chance to prove their communist principles and because they owed Stalin their lives and this new chance. From 1933 to 1936, the Soviet apparatus attacked indigenous actors on charges of being nationalists and counter-revolutionaries, and they attacked European actors for chauvinism and incompetence. Anytime anyone tried to challenge the OGPU for being lawless and violent, they were caught within the OGPU's web. Shadunts eventually replaced Brodo as leader of the party. He was promoted during a period of recovery for Tajikistan. People were recovering from the first and second five-year plans, and productivity was increasing. Yet, 1935 was the same year for another purge. In total, 476 party members lost their party cards because they were bureaucrats, corrupt officials, and class enemies. This was a precursor to the Great Purge of 1936-1938. The party members who were purged in 1935 were restored, and the OGBU began the hunt for those who falsely accused the good communists in order to undermine the Soviet Union. Sotomor proceeded cautiously, basically asking how was it possible for the NKVD to arrest clearly good communists. However, he also knew the restoration could be receded as quickly, and then he would be blamed for restoring a bad communist. His caution didn't save him, and he would be executed in spring 1938. His sudden fall shocked the communists of Tajikistan, and the only way Rakhimbev could explain it was, quote, for almost 2 years, Shadunts led the party, and suddenly he was removed from his post. What happened? This happened, because comrades Shadunts turned out to be a bad political leader. He turned out to be a liberal. He could not combine economic work with political soberness with party work. He failed in Bolshevik instinct to unmask the enemy in a timely manner. This is why he had to go. The Central Committee was fully right to dismiss Shadunts. Quote is from Botikov's Kasim Batova's book, Despite Cultures. Rakhimbev and Brodo shortly joined Shadunts along with an entire generation of indigenous and European intellectuals and leaders who were unlucky enough to be targeted by the NKVD. Part 5C, The Great Terror. The Great Terror arrived in Central Asia in 1937 with the arrest of Feyzullah Zojev and Akmal Ikramov. They were both arrested on June 1937 and were charged with several different counter-revolutionary activities. They were simultaneously part of a bloc of Rites and Trotskyites, who wanted to dismantle the Soviet Union. Milli Ittihad, whose goal was to either engage in wrecking, diversionist, and terrorist activities, undermining the military power of the USSR, provoking a military attack on the Soviet Union, or they were part of organizations that wanted to separate Uzbekistan from the Soviet Union and join a British protectorate. Both men were executed on March 15, 1938. Chopin was arrested on July 13, 1937, Fitchrat was arrested on July 22nd, and Poldiri was arrested on December 31, 1937. They were joined by hundreds of others, including many who attacked them so vehemently to prove they were in fact real communists. The charges brought against them were ludicrous. They were the clear design of paranoid and bored minds who needed people to blame for the failures of Soviet policies because the hounds of nationalism had been unleashed and could not be recalled. Fitchrat, quote-unquote, confessed to being the leader of Milli Ittihad, recruited by Feyzullah, who was the chairman of the Bukharan Soviet Republic at the time, so clearly he had a lot of free time on his hands to create all these secret societies and counter-revolutionary plots. Fitchrat, Zojev, and Munavar Khoury, among others, had organized the Basmachi to destroy the Soviet Union. Khoury was accused of being a Trotskyite and being associated with the terrible nationalists Zojev and Ikhromov. Their records are said to survive, but are sealed except to a select few. They mostly paint a depressingly familiar picture of torture, false confessions, deep betrayals, and the shattering of desperate humans. The hallmark of not only the Soviet Union, but any government that wants to break its people, not support them. Over 383 lists with almost 44,000 names of accused nationalists and counter-revolutionaries were sent to the Politburo, and then Stalin for his signature. A vast majority of them were executed. Some of the names included Evgenia Zeltkin, Ikhromov's wife, Hadi Fazi, and Ramazan Inagamov. Others who were not on the list were still arrested and executed, such as Botu and Tula Ryskulov, while others, like Lazi Azoda, were arrested and went from camp to camp before being released. And then there was Sadruddin Ani, who somehow managed to avoid arrest and died in his bed in 1954 at the age of 76. In the biggest farce of this entire madness was the Supreme Military Court of the USSR. It held a session in Kashkent on October 5, 1938, to sentence the guilty counter-revolutionaries. However, everyone had already been executed the night before, on October 4th. It was a shameful window dressing of a massacre based on paranoia, colonialism, and a love for power. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as anyone can enjoy an episode about mass murder. And I hope you've enjoyed our second season in which we've discussed Central Asia during the Russian Civil War. I also hope you're excited for the third season on the Irish Civil War, which will launch in June. So keep an eye on all my social media channels and my Patreon, www.patreon.com/AOAwarfare. If you enjoyed this episode and this season, you can listen to my full catalog on Spotify, iTunes, and my website, www.samswarroom.com. Until next time, wear a mask, organize your community, and stay safe.